Thank you all for joining. This is Divorce Friday, the podcast that answers your financial questions about divorce. Today, we are fortunate to have as a guest, Fern Frohlin. Fern Frohlin is a distinguished family law attorney in Massachusetts. She has been with many firms in the Commonwealth, and she has also been on the task forces for the every 4 year review of child support in Massachusetts, at least since 2012. Is that right? Right.
Yes.
And she has also participated in the task force that led to the Alimony Reform Act of 2011, which is now the fundamental law in Massachusetts for alimony. So today we are starting a new season of the podcast, and we'll be addressing, over the next 10 episodes, we'll be addressing alimony in Massachusetts. And we're very lucky to have you, Fern, as our first guest here. I think we're going to be talking about a number of topics, but potentially we're going to start first with some of the history behind alimony. Alimony wasn't always a given. I think divorce was not always a given either. When he started being allowed, without alimony, which made it really difficult and impractical for most people. Right. So when did we first start talking about implementing alimony in the law?
Well, actually, alimony goes back to 1700 BC. So a really long time, well before divorce. And the word alimony is actually a Latin word, alimonia, which means nourishment. So the idea of support, not necessarily a fixed amount on a monthly basis, with dowry, think of dowry in ancient cultures and some modern cultures that still have dowry, comes from the notion that traditionally, only men could be property owners. So if the a married couple split up, or even if there wasn't divorce, if the owner of property and the person with income left, that left the other person without any form of support. And different cultures recognize that all the way down to BC. In modern American culture, the last state to award alimony as recently as probably 20 years ago was Texas. So, each state has its own law about alimony and how much it can be and how long it can last.
Yeah, I didn't realize.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize that it was that ancient. I know that to some extent, there were other forms of transactions that were sort of alimony-like. You mentioned the dowries, and I think you're still expecting in some cultures that the dowry will help to support the wife in case something happens. And something that happens is not just potentially the husband leaving, but potentially also the husband dying or something, right?
That's absolutely true.
Right. And so the need for that has been recognized for a long time, right? And
right.
So at this point, it seems that for that in this country, at least, it seems that divorce has started to become much more of an issue after World War II, and then alimony followed after that. Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah, more or less. So alimony is payments for the support of a spouse in the form of alimony are by statute only. There's no common law right to, for our listeners, common law means that the courts decided it, and statutes mean that a legislature, like Congress or the state legislature, decided it. There's no court-imposed right to alimony. Alimony comes from statute. Our statutes do go back hundreds of years, but the amounts were a pittance until after World War II. The amounts were negligible, and they were largely based on fault If you were at fault, if the economically dependent spouse was the one who caused the end of the marriage in the eyes of a fact finder, say a court, then that person couldn't get alimony. And that's changed. Alimony today is part of the general economic ordering of relationships that recognizes that couples who marry are a family unit and that they are economically intertwined and independent in a way that's difficult to separate when the marriage ends, unless they've made a contract. If they've made a prenuptial contract, then they know how it's going to end. But very few couples opt for that. And as a matter of public policy, we've only had prenuptial contracts for a few decades. So we needed alimony, and most couples don't have it as part of the overall means of supporting both parties at the end of divorce. I would like for a second to talk about the whole scheme of economic interdependence among married couples, because the parts can't be separated and aren't intended to be separated as a matter of public policy. When two people marry, if they don't have a prenuptial agreement, there's an implied contract that they will stay together and be economically independent and take care of each other and be obligated to do that forever.
If I may, it's not implied.
What?
If I may, it is not implied. It's part of the marital vows.
Well, yes, but even if you don't say it in your vows, you know, even if you got married in Colorado where two people don't need an officiant, where they can stand on a mountaintop and promise to love each other forever, unless they've done something in writing that's very complex and enforceable, like a prenup agreement, or in some cultures, a dowry, that the government implies, because part of that is to stay together forever. And now part of that implied contract, we let people out. Well, if you're letting people out of that part of the contract, what happens to all the rest to take care of each other forever? So until 1975, there was no right to division of property in divorce in Massachusetts. That's pretty recent. If a couple divorced and the property was all in one party's name, whether it was husband or wife, that party left with 100% of the property. You had to have some means to take care of that part of the implied contract to support the other person. But the amounts were totally all over the place. How much it would be, how often it would get paid, how long would it last. And our courts at that point expounded on the idea that it was based on need and ability to pay.
It's an interesting point in the sense that you are reaching out to some of the more understandable foundations for most of us, because people who go through divorce hear that all the time, right, is need and ability to pay, right? And so before that, you were saying up to 1975, it was, you said, all over the place, which means that essentially it wasn't really governed by statute, right? It was governed by case law.
The only thing the statute said was that the court could award alimony, period. That's what it said.
Right.
And then and every judge, and that the judge who was deciding it had a great deal of discretion.
Oh, so, I think they still have.
Some judges made very large alimony awards, not large by today's standards. Some made very minimal alimony awards, and it depended not just on where you lived or what county, what part of the state. Now we're talking about for Massachusetts, but which judge you drew in that particular county, how much you would get. And the other important thing that the court said that was never in the statute was that it was a snapshot. This is the appellate courts. So it governed all the lower courts. Think of the Supreme Court making laws for everyone in the United States. This is just for our state. That it was a snapshot in time. That it was today the dependent spouse needs X number of dollars per month. But they didn't, the appellate courts did not permit the trial court the discretion to say, but in 5 years, things will be different, or let's look to the future. The appellate court said, we can't look into the future. We can only look at today. So if we look at today and decide, let's call it wife, needs $100 a week alimony to maintain whatever standard of living the court has decided is appropriate. And over time, that came to be defined by the court, the appropriate standard of living, as the standard of living during the marriage. Today, they couldn't say, but in 5 years, that person will need less, or that person may need more due to age, or the person with the ability to pay, let's call it the husband, because at that point in time, it was husbands almost always, might not have the ability to pay, might become disabled, might retire. In order to keep this going, because there was no projection of future needs and future ability to pay, it disincentivized people to plan for the future. It prevented recipients from remarrying, because why would I remarry and give up my sole source of support? Especially after one appellate decision in the 1980s said that the court couldn't terminate alimony based on cohabitation. So you could live with, and it became socially acceptable to cohabitate. So you could live with someone and continue your alimony, which was deemed unfair by the people who were paying the alimony.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. So wasn't there a time when the social standard, at least, was a maintenance of the previous lifestyle?
There was, and that was imposed by the appellate court. They said that defines need. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the movement to change the law in 2016, I think, is the alimony, 2014 is the Alimony Reform Act. But it took, as I said, it took decades to get there, was that if a couple was married, let's suppose that someone out of school with no earnings history at all and coming from nothing marries someone who is well established in life, and the lifestyle ratchets up from a very modest level to a very high level, and the marriage only lasts a year and a half, 5 years. Would it make sense to award an indefinite period, because that's what our appellate court said, that it had to be indefinite until circumstances changed, because we weren't allowing courts to project into the future how circumstances might change, to someone who was married for 3 years at a high standard of living to be maintained at that high standard of living for maybe 20 years or 30 years.
Or forever,
well, till death. And that, until the death of the recipient, really, because of life insurance requirements. And that led to the courts, the judge at the lower court level, at the trial court, who has discretion, saying, I'm not awarding that. And as a result, that recipient spouse would get zero for alimony.
Yes,
nothing. Because a 20 order didn't make any sense, and the courts felt constrained, the trial court, the judge making the decision, constrained not to make an order that would be based on standard of living. And so there was a clamor for what we now call, both in the law and I think colloquial, durational limits. And the durational limits, therefore, are tied to the length of the marriage. The longer you were married, the longer the alimony period should extend. Massachusetts was not in the forefront of this. This was following other jurisdictions.
Okay. So I started getting involved in divorce shortly before the Alimony Reform Act. right? And so I think it might be interesting to review a little bit about what happened before that and what led to that to the Alimony Reform Act. It seems from memory there that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the state of divorce at the time, especially from payors. Right, that they felt that the issue about that it was too much, and certainly that it would be it was too long, the indefinite part, right, being too long, right. Were there other issues?
There was a public recognition that it, as I said a couple minutes ago, that it disincentivized people to plan for the future. That it disincentivized a dependent spouse who has the ability to go back to work to save for the future, because they didn't, in an alimony award, it shouldn't just look at income. It looks at income and assets as means for support. So if you wanted to preserve your alimony, you might not participate in retirement savings. And there was financial planning offered around that. Certainly people came to me as a lawyer and said, you know, what should I do with my money so it doesn't show? You know, should I gift it, for example? But the big thing was retirement. The big thing is that because the single biggest item, because it was based on a snapshot that was entered when someone was working, a person couldn't say, I'm going to retire at X age, unless their spouse agreed to the retirement and the reduction, their former spouse, because you could always make an agreement outside the, you know, what the law would provide. And lots of reasonable people did. But if your spouse, the dependent spouse, wouldn't agree, I would have to retire first and then find out how much I had to pay and whether I was going to be able to afford to make my payments. And there was a very important case of a man who, he actually was a lawyer, was a retired judge and then practiced law and made a good deal of money after a 33-year marriage. His alimony was, I think it was in the six figures, and I don't remember how much it was, 100,000 or 150,000, but it was in the six figure range. And he reached age 65 and he wanted to retire, and he brought a reduction case saying, as a matter of public policy, a modification, a change, I should be allowed to stop paying alimony. His former spouse, who did work, had been laid off from her job. And she said, I've depended on this. I haven't saved for the future. She had a pittance in savings. And it's not fair to me if he voluntarily retires. So what the trial judge did, which was probably pretty wise, was she reduced Mr. Pierce's alimony from the six figures to about $40,000 a year. And wife said, all right, I'll take it, you know, and that, but husband said, I think it should be zero. And he brought an appellate. He went to the appeals court and then to the SJC. And the SJC affirmed the trial court and said that was a good solution. And everyone turned around and said, we're looking at the numbers. $40,000 is still a burden for him under these circumstances. And it's not his fault that she didn't save money over all of those years. And that gave the political support to the group of payors who had already organized to try to put some limits on what they were on their payments. And it made sense.
Right. I mean, as a financial planner, it makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, if a couple is going to retire, they're going to live on retirement savings. And if they have no retirement savings, then they're going to have a difficult time. Right. But when the divorce, the same thing should be happening from the point of view of a financial planner, is that that both parties end up living on retirement savings. Right. And so to me, the notion that that it should be indefinite because she didn't save, it doesn't really play that well either. But it's more like a question of the general of general financial illiteracy than of it being her fault, if you will.
And the Alimony Reform Act, while it has presumptive time limits, also has the ability for a court or the parties on their own, of course, to go outside those limits, to make changes, to say, yes, the plan was for the dependent spouse to be economically self-sufficient within a certain number of years, but it didn't work because let's say COVID happened, you know, and everything changed. Let's just say a pandemic came.
That's
and so then the judge can modify. I'm sorry?
Totally preposterous.
Totally, but could never happen. The other big political force was the an appellate decision. It's actually quite a while ago. I think it was late 80s that the court did not have the ability to terminate alimony if the dependent spouse was permanently cohabiting with someone not married to that person. So that was one thing. And then there was a kind of crazy decision where there was always termination on remarriage because that implied contract ended and the dependent spouse had a new implied contract. A dependent spouse remarried and then divorced again, and second husband didn't have money to pay alimony, had no ability to pay. And so former wife went back to husband number one and was able to get alimony again from husband number one. Those three things, even though that was only one case, caused the legislature to say, yep, time to do something.
Time to do something.
Time to do something. And then the legislature appointed a task force, which was a committee of all stakeholders. And I was on it on behalf of the Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. It was state senators and state representatives and Women's Bar Association and all the, Mass Bar Association to get together and draft something that was acceptable to all stakeholders. And it took, I think, a year and a half, and they put us in a room on the top floor of the state house without air conditioning. And we met twice a month in this room that was hot in the summer because there was no air conditioning and hot in the winter because all the heat rose up to it. and said, okay, figure it out. And that's why I think it's not going to get amended anytime soon.
So did you let out smoke when you were there?
I would go outside and fill the water bottles.
Okay. So we've been, I think, going from historical underpinnings to that recent law. I think it was passed in 2011, right? And I think you already addressed some of the things that it was trying to do, right? So for instance, the issue of durational limits, right? So it imposes some durational limits. It imposes the limit on cohabitation, right? And it also talks about amounts for general alimony. Are there other major features that the public should know about?
Well, I think the biggest feature, which unfortunately has been used much less than we had hoped, and which we borrowed from some scholarly writing, law professors had said this is the way alimony should work across the country, and from a few other states that were in the forefront of changes, restructuring alimony to different types of alimony. So you could say this is a good case for alimony as we've known it, which we just called general term alimony to differentiate it from other kinds of alimony. But the next case, may, for you as a financial planner or me as a lawyer, might be a good case for something called rehabilitative alimony, which we had never had before. And so we set up different kinds of alimony, rehabilitative, transitional, reimbursement, and general term are the four kinds. And they have different features. And a trial judge now can look at the facts of the case and say, this is a good case for example, rehabilitative alimony.
Right. So that's really pretty interesting, right? Because most people think of alimony in terms of what we call general term alimony, which means alimony, I think, that is based on the parties' need and ability to pay and basically their respective incomes, right? And the other three there are interesting because most people don't know about them, right? And so maybe we can go a little bit to some of them. Like maybe we can start with, reimbursement alimony. What is reimbursement alimony?
Okay. It's really interesting because it's not what we generally think of as alimony. It literally is intended to repay one of the parties to a marriage, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be the dependent spouse, for contribution in a short-term marriage. The statute doesn't say it has, I don't think, it has to be a marriage of less than a certain number of years, but that's really what it's for. So not as short as transitional, that's really for a short-term marriage. So let's suppose that one of the spouses contributes to the down payment of a house that the other person is going to keep. And it's a marriage, maybe without children and maybe very short term, and both parties can be self-supporting, but there's not enough cash in the marriage at the time of divorce for the person who's keeping the house to pay off the other person their investment in the house. So now a way to do that is through reimbursement alimony. And you just say, this is how much it should be, and this is the interest that you should be paid on that amount of money that you invested, and here's how the period of time that you're going to get it back. It's less interesting to us now that alimony is not tax deductible, and that gets into some esoterics of it was more valuable when before the Trump Administration Tax Act eliminated the tax deduction for alimony there were some tax features to it. But that's what reimbursement is for. And it's non-modifiable because it's a finite sum. We decide what the sum is and how it's going to be paid back over what period of time and what the payments will be. And you can't go back and change it because that wouldn't change with circumstances. That's already a fixed feature of the marriage.
Right. So an example I hear often about that is, when a spouse supports, when someone supports their spouse going through graduate school or something like that, right? And then the spouse graduates and all of a sudden they want to get divorced.
That's correct. And what's interesting in Massachusetts law is that unlike some states, a minority of states, a professional degree does not have value that can be divided as property.
That's right.
So, for example, in New York, a professional degree does have value. If someone gets it used to be an MD, but that's less valuable than it used to be, a PhD in robotics from MIT.
Artificial intelligence.
AI, there you go. The court could say that the value of that degree to you in earning capacity over time is X, and your spouse is going to get a property share of it. And that's not true in Massachusetts. Right. So it couldn't be awarded as property. And so reimbursement alimony is a way to recognize the value of the support. And by the way, the support does not have to be economic support. It doesn't have to be that I was working and paid the bills. It could be that we had three children and my spouse, went back to work and I did 100%, took on 100% of everything. And we lived on savings while you were in school, but I'm running the household. That also counts. You can still get reimbursed for that too.
Yeah, I think maybe we skipped that part when we were talking earlier about history, but it's still the issue that often women stay home to raise their children. And it's recognized now that it is work and it is unpaid work and needs to be recognized somehow at the time of divorce. Right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. So I don't know that we're seeing it. I would hope that through your Divorce Fridays and other popular presentations that people interested in this topic look at, that the public would know and say to your lawyer, I think I might be entitled to reimbursement alimony. And another feature is that it's not really subject to, besides not being subject to modification, it's not really subject to the amount limits that we would see in other events. It in other kinds of alimony, it is of course subject to ability to pay, and that's going to probably affect the duration of the payment. So you might get paid a smaller amount over a longer period of time.
Okay. All right. So how about rehabilitative alimony? That sounds sort of strange, right? Because it sounds like someone has fallen down the stairs and needs to be.
That is probably the most important feature from the view of the task force that drafted the bill, which is the notion that a person has need now, but ought to, if possible, strive to be self-supporting within a period of time. As a matter of public policy, it's not good financial planning for me to expect or hope that my former spouse will never become disabled or that for any reason that I should be dependent on someone else that I cannot control, cannot manage, or won't have a premature death or something.
Right.
The best financial planning is how I'm going to take care of myself. And rehabilitative alimony is aimed at looking at a point in time in the future when a person no longer has need. That's what it's for. I have need today, because we're talking need and ability to pay. And depending on ability to pay is not good financial planning. So I have to have my own income coming in. That's what rehabilitative alimony is for. And the court is, or the parties are supposed to pick a date certain in the future when there will no longer be need, or although the statute doesn't specify it, maybe there will be less need. Maybe there will be need for $1,000 a week of alimony for X period of years. And then I'm going to work at some job that will provide part of my support, but not all of it. So it might be while I'm going to school, training for something. That it's typically that. It could also be something like, we have a business and we know the business is going to be sold and I'm going to be cashed out of the business on the date of sale to occur within the next 15 years. And whenever that is, I'm going to get my cash from the business and then I'll no longer have need. It could also be that, but that would be less common.
So I think I mentioned to you before we got onto this that I have had the example of someone who she had been married for, I think it's like close to 15 years. Right. And now she's getting divorced and she's getting rehabilitative alimony to pay, in fact, for support for expenses and graduate school tuition while she goes to a master's in engineering. And it seemed to me that it's really great in many ways. Right? It's back to that question about people supporting themselves is back about self-esteem, actually, right? About being able to say that I have, I'm worth something besides being just someone's ex-spouse, right? Are there other examples like that you can think of?
Well, career training, changing careers is the most obvious. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that I can think of other rehabilitative alimony scenarios that I've been involved in. I do think it's important to note that unlike reimbursement alimony, it's rehabilitative alimony is modifiable. And the burden is on the dependent spouse, the recipient, to show and that they made an effort to do whatever was planned right. to be done during the marriage. But suppose a pandemic would come, the unthinkable thing. And I made an effort and I was not able to become self-supporting. If the recipient can show compelling circumstances, it can be extended. And we saw extensions definitely during the pandemic of payments that would have expired but for the pandemic because people couldn't complete degrees because there wasn't schooling and
it was difficult.
Yeah.
Maybe
you can think of other rehabilitative alimony scenarios, but the ones we've talked about are pretty much the most common.
That's what I come across. I mean, that recent case of going to graduate school was one thing. I come across people who go back for a nurse practitioner degree. Right. Or even for that matter, it doesn't all have to be high-end degrees. I have the case of someone who went to community college to get their radiology certification. Mm-hmm. And I mean, all of these are valid in the sense that they help train people to qualify for a job that that will mean that they won't need a general alimony.
And, you know, from a public policy point of view, full employment is a public benefit. You know, the more people in the workforce, the more people who are paying into the Social Security system, the more money there is to pay the people who are retiring on the other end of the Social Security system. As a matter of public policy, incentivizing people to work is really important.
Right.
And I would like to see it used more, rehabilitative alimony, than it is.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, for the reasons that we talked about, it sounds like a really good way to mm-hmm. plan.
The last one's transitional that we haven't talked about. Yeah.
So what about transitional alimony? What the heck is that?
We're seeing almost none of those. That really is for the very, very short-term marriages, where the goal is not to maintain the lifestyle of the marriage. That's the example that I started with a while ago in our conversation, which is that you might have someone who moves for the marriage. You know, I lived in a much lower cost of living state, and I moved to Massachusetts because I married someone who was employed in Massachusetts. And I want to go back to that lower cost of living state. The transitional alimony is intended solely for the amount of time and financial support that it will take to get back to doing what I was doing before.
Talking over one another. But in the example that you gave, it's really about helping the person move back to wherever it is that they wanted to move to, and provide maybe a few months of expenses.
Yeah, the statute only provides for up to 3 years of payments at a maximum. So it can't go on and on. And it's not modifiable, and the court does not have the ability to convert it to another form of alimony. There's okay. nothing that prevents the court in the statute from converting rehabilitative alimony to another form, but transitional alimony cannot be converted. It's just, you know, it's really for the very short-term marriages, and to help that person who would not have gotten any support whatsoever before the Alimony Reform Act.
Okay. All right. So these are three interesting subsets of alimony that we don't often come across, or that the public at least doesn't often come across. What they come across is general alimony, general term alimony. And so how is that structured now? How is general term alimony structured from that Alimony Reform Act?
We have durational limits, as I said, that are based on the length of the marriage. The longer the marriage, the longer the term of alimony is presumptively going to last. And when I said presumption, people, listeners, should recognize that a presumption is shifts the burden of showing that it should be something different. So if your soon-to-be former spouse is coming in and saying, under the Alimony Reform Act, I have to pay for X number of months, that's not entirely correct. It's under the Alimony Reform Act, it's presumed that I will pay for X number of months based on how long we were married. And then the burden shifts to the recipient to say, and here's why that presumption shouldn't apply to our case. It starts with marriages of 5 years or less, it's 50% of the length of marriage is my memory. And the length of time goes up all the way to the, it's 80% of the length, number of months of the marriage, the length of time of payments, up to a 20-year marriage. And after 20 years, there is no presumptive durational limit. However, there's still a presumption that the payor has the ability to terminate payments upon reaching full retirement age.
Right.
So if you were to divorce when, which full retirement age is defined by Social Security, the Social Security Act, and it's presently 67 and a half, but it could, that could be amended by Congress to change whatever full retirement, presumptive full retirement age is.
Yeah, of course. So was that the nod to the example that you gave earlier about that former judge who went into private practice and who was being asked to pay through his retirement?
That's exactly what it was.
Right.
That was in recognition, even though I think we all thought that the trial judge had done exactly the right thing in that circumstance, because we know that that spouse had been married for 32 years and expected that Mr. Pierce was going to pay support until, and there was a, that case was, that contract for divorce, that was an agreement. That wasn't imposed by some judge who said it's going to be until you die. The parties wrote it's until we die. So, you know, even though we could all agree that the judge had done the right thing in that case, well, some of us didn't agree, but most of us could agree that the judge had done the right thing in that case. We wanted to make sure that for the next group of people divorcing after the Alimony Reform Act, thank you for remembering how long ago it was. It makes me feel old. 2011.
Doesn't make me feel young.
For the next group of people who would be divorcing after that, they wouldn't be in Mrs. Pierce's position of thinking they were going to get paid until they died. They would know that they had to save, invest, plan, and know what their end date would be. Now, we fully expected that if people retired late in life, very close to retirement, divorced very late in life, close to retirement age, and that's actually in the statute, that's a reason to extend the payment time. If presumptive retirement is at 67, and the economically advantaged spouse, who would be the payor, decides at age 65 to leave and says, guess what, you only get 2 years of alimony. And the marital plan up to that point hadn't saved enough savings for the family to otherwise have retired at that age, then that's a good reason for the dependent spouse to come in and say, yeah, but our plan was that you were going to work till 72. And you can see that in the numbers. And then obviously extend the retirement age.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a common issue that people think about saving for retirement right around the time that it comes. More than one person has come into my office and told me that, oh, I've retired last month. Now I need to know if I have enough.
Yes. Well, that wasn't the goal. The goal was to plan ahead, but we can't change human nature. I mean, right. You know, we can only provide incentives and disincentives. We can't change change.
Right. And so I think it's sort of an interesting point, right? Because for people who will read the law, so it does say in there that alimony stops at full retirement age as defined by the Social Security Administration, right? But it can be extended. It doesn't have to be 67, it could be later, right? Practically speaking, are there limits? I mean, some people, for instance, can work for a long time, like physicians routinely work up to 80 or even beyond.
Academics, are they, academics. It's actually, in the academic world, the age discrimination law has made it very, very difficult to impose any retirement at all on a tenured professor, almost impossible. Right. And those people work a very long time. The only people I know who work longer are federal judges who might work to 90. But, you know, it's interesting. We, as a task force, talked about making the presumptive age the presumptive age of retirement in the profession. So, for example, firefighters really retire before they're 50, often in their middle, early 40s.
Yeah.
And I know they often go on to other jobs as
well. They have a tremendous retirement plan, which allows them to do that.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we decided not to do that, but to have one date for everyone. And to let Congress effectively set what that date is in the, through the Social Security Act, because people who retire early, this was the sentiment, this was a consensus sentiment.
Oops, it looks like we have lost Fern, and she will be coming back soon, I'm sure. It sounds like a little bit of a technical glitch. And hopefully we can get over that in just a minute. But just to review some of the stuff that we have talked about is that the alimony law, that is Alimony Reform Act of 2011, does cover a lot of issues and is fundamental to everything else that has happened since. And the issue that we were talking about just now were about the durational limits. And the durational limits go from 50% of the time that you're married, that Fern mentioned, when the marriage has been 5 years or less, to all the way till full retirement age as defined by Social Security. So for people who were born in 1960, or later, it is going to be 67. For people who are born before that, they're approaching their full retirement age as it is. And so it may or may not be applicable. Also, something that is worth noting is that there are possible deviations from that. Right? And I've come across several of them in my practice where the where the alimony would last until after 67. The circumstances are all over the place, so I give a warning at the end if you are considering marriage, please do consider talking to a professional. It is a complex issue, and it is not something that you want to try to do on your own if you're going to be affected by that. The other thing that happens with the alimony law, and hopefully Fern will come back in a second, right, is the issue of amounts, right? So the base, and she's coming back. Welcome back.
I'm so sorry, I had a technology catastrophe.
Oh, these things happen all the time, as you know.
Okay, what did I miss?
Huh?
I wondered what I missed.
So I think we were towards the end of a discussion on the durational limits, and I took advantage of the time to recap that. right? And I was wondering about something though, is that, is back to that issue about who gets to retire early or late, and professions, knowledge-based professions, such as you mentioned judges, academics, I mentioned physicians, get to retire later if they so choose, right? But there are other people who can't do that, right? Like, so for instance, if you are, if you work with your hands, for instance, it's a lot harder. Right. So if you are, I think the example that I keep coming across is that of a plumber, right? So a plumber will spend potentially their lifetime having their hands in cold water, and they will have arthritis way before 60, right? And so how does that work for someone like that?
Well, I think that hopefully that couple, as a family planning matter, recognize that and plan for an earlier retirement, and will structure their own agreement by agreement that has the alimony duration be shorter and have saved appropriately. If not, if you have to present that to a fact finder or a judge, the judge has the ability to set an earlier retirement age, but that's modifying the statute gives the judge that discretion. The burden is on the person who's going to want to retire earlier. I think what I was saying when I suddenly lost all connections here was that there's frequently a disagreement, whatever the agreement may or may not have been during the marriage, there's frequently a disagreement about what the retirement plan was at the time of divorce.
Right.
And that's like every other disagreement. It needs to be resolved through mediation, arbitration, or court. You know, or negotiation at your kitchen table. But it's always harder if people disagree about what the fundamental underpinnings of their economic relationship were.
So I think for people who have done their work of saving for retirement during their lifetime, it's easier for them, right? As they approach retirement, they can decide that they don't need it because they have enough assets to support themselves and stuff. But it's the challenge is really for those who haven't been, who haven't saved or haven't been able to save for retirement, because then we have a burden both on the payor, right? Who is, when they pay out, we may not be able to save for their own retirement, or the recipient who is still getting less than they had before and can't save for retirement either.
Well, and that actually brings us kind of full circle to Mr. and Mrs. Pierce, who, without knowing it, provided the impetus for a complete restructuring of alimony in our Commonwealth. What the appellate court said was, we recognize that when Mr. Pierce retires, there's going to be less money to go around. But we also recognize that it's not appropriate to require anyone to work past a reasonable work age. It happened that he retired at 65, which we would, as a task force, found younger than it needed to be. But you can get Social Security reduced benefits at 65, so it's not an unheard of retirement age. And the public accounting firms and many law firms, for example, make partners retire at 62 just to make room for the younger people to become partners.
Right.
So what the court said in its wisdom, and that is still very good law, even though the case has now been changed in some ways by the Alimony Reform Act, is that when there's not enough money to go around, there has to be a fair sharing of sacrifice. And we talk all the time about balance of sacrifice, that for most people, there isn't enough money to maintain the standard of living that worked for one household in two households.
Right.
And we use that not just for alimony, but for the economic apportionment generally, fair balance of sacrifice. There's going to be a sacrifice. The burden shouldn't fall entirely on one of the two former spouses, assuming a long-term marriage.
Yes, unfortunately. Having two households is going to take more to support than one household, and it's going to require some adjustments, right? So let's say reality. So mm-hmm. the other major thing that the Alimony Reform Act was addressing was the amounts of payments. One other thing that was interesting is that it actually prescribes a range, right? Between, what was it, 30% and 35%, right? So how did that come about? What did it come about?
There's a long history of that. Alimony awards used to be, before our appellate court said need is defined by standard of living during the marriage. And the seminal case that that established that, there were earlier cases that mentioned it, but the one that was that really rang everyone's bell and made people sit up was when the couple that owned Dunkin' Donuts, not a franchise, the whole thing, divorced. What's need is defined by how they live during the marriage. So up until that time, the awards were very small. It was, what do you need to pay your rent and put food on your table and maybe gas in your car, and that's it. And then it was broadened to include the luxuries that people might have. And then a very influential judge named Judge Ginsburg took that and said, well, that's amorphous. And he wrote a lot. He was influential because he had an academic bent. He did a lot of academic writing about what family law ought to be, how it ought to be applied. And he devised this one-third formula, a third for the government because the wage earner or business person had to pay income taxes. And this is rough and dirty, and he wanted it to apply to most people on average. And then of the two-thirds that's left to keep, splitting them equally, a third for the payer or a third for the recipient. Wasn't really accurate, but that was Judge Ginsburg's pronouncement daily, several times a day from the bench. Well, I know you think it's a lot, or I know you think it's not enough, but it's a third, and a third. And that became the practice for a long time. And then Judge Ginsburg thought, well, really the taxes are more than a third. And he devised a very complicated formula that was meant to equalize income. It was never adopted by anyone. So it didn't have the same influence, not worth a lot of discussion, his more complicated formula. But the one-third kind of inched up. And then because I said that our task force had to reach consensus, every single piece of that statute at the time, we may not think it's perfect now in practice because things don't work out the way you envision. But at the time, everyone around the table, no matter what their self-interest was able to nod and say, I could live with that. And we couldn't come to a number. So hence the range 30 to 35. We couldn't come to one number that everybody could add and say, I can live with that. So we got 30 to 35, which assumed that the recipient was going to pay taxes on it and that the payer was going to deduct it. And that's no longer the law. So that's meant to be a presumptive maximum threshold, not an absolute, but a presumptive. That has inched down to account for the tax shift.
I think you mentioned something interesting there about the equalization of incomes. I was under the impression that the goal wasn't to equalize.
It's not. That's why his more complicated formula never became. It was Judge Ginsburg's thought of having a complicated formula that would do that. But in fact, the appellate courts have said the goal is not equalizing. The goal is shared sacrifice, if sacrifice need be made, and to approximate the lifestyle in each household. And we have definitely moved very far away from precise equalization of income. And there is a recognition that it's one thing if the recipient spouse is maintaining household and raising children and managing social life, for example. And it's another thing if it's later in life and effectively that recipient spouse, the kids are off in college, they've downsized to a smaller house, and the payor has fewer obligations, and the payor spouse is, you know, still carrying her tools and going to work as a plumber, you know, and that there's a cost to going to work. There's parking and uniforms or clothing or whatever it is. There's a cost to going to work too. So we value work, I think, and I help people recognize that.
Excellent. So I think you mentioned the tax issues, right? So at the time the Alimony Reform Act was written, alimony was deductible from taxable income, and it was added to taxable income for the recipient. And so the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which you referred to earlier also, was passed in 2017, and it abolished the deductibility of alimony, right? So as a result, it seems that when that happened, there was a little bit of a float, right? But it seems that we have sort of hardened around a 25% limit.
I think that's correct. I think we have come to the pendulum maybe has come to rest at the point of 25%. That's for convenience. Mm-hmm. There are tables out there that were done by some very bright accountants that'll tell you, depending on what the incomes are, where the exact post-tax net value is to both parties. But even that's not precise, because different people have people who are self-employed pay more taxes on the self-employment side. I mean, every couple is different, and you could actually get an accountant to do that for you if you wanted to figure out what it is in non-tax shifted dollars, what it would be. But I think people want predictability. It's come to rest around 25%.
And I think the issue really is that obviously the recipient always wants more, because it doesn't seem to cover expenses. And the payor wants to pay less because it's a big chunk, right? But when we talk about variations around even like 30 to 35% before the TCJA, or 25% plus or minus 3%, it doesn't really make a tremendous amount of difference. It certainly doesn't seem to warrant too much discussion.
I think that's right. I think the interestingly, the 30% to 35% had come to an equilibrium at 32.5. There was a lot of 32.5. So those advocates for recipients who had pushed the presumptive number up to 35% actually ended up giving up a 0.5%. I think for many people, what they want is predictability and fairness. And they think it's fair if it's the same as their neighbors are doing, the same as people they don't know are doing.
Yeah, obviously. So we're sort of at the end of our time there, but how do you feel that alimony might evolve now that given where we are today with that?
You know, other than taking a look at what the actual net number is, net, I mean what the untaxed adjusted percentages are, I don't see a big change coming in alimony. I think the Alimony Reform Act was a lot to swallow for people. What I'm hoping for is more education. So for example, that we recently had a very big increase in the amount of income that's covered by child support. And child support is not alimony. Child support is meant to be the incremental difference between the cost of a household with one or two adults and the cost of the same household with children living in the household. It's meant to cover the children. So to the extent that we had to raise the amount of income covered by child support in order for fairness to for those non-alimony families to for the child support numbers to be sufficient. I hope that that's not eating into, or there will come to be a public recognition that that should not eat into dollars available for alimony. Child support percentages are much lower than the 25% that we've been talking about for alimony, much, much lower. And it doesn't make sense to divert alimony dollars that would have been 25% of the difference in gross income to shift those that for the support of one person to shift those dollars to be now 10% for the support of say three people. It just does, it's not logical. Right. And so I'm hoping that we'll get that as a matter of public awareness. And I don't know how the courts are doing with it.
The consequence of that, of the last review of the child support guidelines, so has been, as you mentioned, to increase the amount of child support, but it seems that there is a collateral a reduction in the amount of alimony as a result.
In my view, that is theoretically wrong,
okay,
economically incorrect, and socially very bad policy.
Okay. All right. So I guess maybe we're going to look for some changes.
I guess I'll have to write an article.
I think we might have to.
We can write it together.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Fern. It's been
thank
great.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
It's really great to have you here. Right. And before we finish off there, I know that I asked you before we started about what you're currently doing. I forgot to mention it in the introduction. And so Fern is working with JAMS, which is the largest ADR, alternative dispute resolution in the country. Right? Is there something else you'd like to add about JAMS?
No, I think that's plenty. Okay. I'm in their Boston office. We're all over the country.
Okay, excellent. JAMS is JAMS, right? And if you need to reach Fern, please feel free to reach us where we said earlier at our email, which is divorcefriday@gmail.com, and or anywhere else. And I will make sure to pass on the information. So I need to remind everyone here that circumstances are different for everyone and that a podcast cannot replace a consultation with a professional. So if you are seriously considering divorce, if you have serious questions about alimony, please do get a consultation with a professional. So we will be back here next week on Friday, March 11th at 11 a.m. And Diane hopefully will be back with us. So this has been Divorce Friday, the podcast that answers financial questions about divorce. Thank you everyone for coming.